Chapter 2. Just around the back from the BBC's special effects department in Acton is the BBC rehearsal rooms. You can see them clearly if you drive down the A40. It's a big yellowish tower block which dominates the surrounding semi-industrial flatlands and cemeteries. As you go in the front door, there's one of those blackboards in the foyer with the white letters you can push in. This tells you what's going on, who's on what floor, and which room. Red Dwarf was on the 5th floor, with the cast from Blackadder on one side of us, and You Rang, My Lord, on the other. Alexei Sale was down below us, and Jim Davidson was there somewhere, I think. Or was it Jimmy Tarbuck? Or Paul Daniels and his wife? Oh, it was marvellous. A thespian village transformed into a tower block. I took the lift to the 5th floor and found my way to our room. There was a little blackboard outside the door, and written in chalk it said, Red Dwarf 3. Director, Ed By, producer, Paul Jackson. I pushed open the big double door and saw that I must have been very late, as there are about 20 people sitting round a big table in the middle of a vast room. I wasn't intimidated. I'm an actor. I said, Hello, in a high-pitched, nervous voice, and tried to find somewhere to sit. I was introduced to so many people, it was hopeless. There was no way I would remember all these people, and I was going to be working with them for the next 10 weeks. Some of them I recognised. Bethan Jones from makeup, Peter Ragg from special effects, Rob and Doug, Ed By, and there was Hattie Hayridge. I knew her. I'd known her for ages. We did stand-up comedy gigs together. I shook hands with Chris Barry.
How do you do, sir?
He said in a fairly formal manner. I shook hands with Danny John Jules.
Yeah, how's it hanging, guy?
He said with a big grin. I shook hands with Craig Charles. What are you looking at, you middle-class bastard? No, I lie. He didn't say that at all. That wasn't until I'd been there for a whole week. He said something like, nice to have you on board, and then he bowed very low. Hattie looked very glamorous and settled, as if she'd been there for weeks. Hello, Hattie, I said nervously, and tried to sit near her. In the middle of the table was a big pile of scripts. We were at the read-through, the first time each series, when Rob and Doug get to hear the cast saying their words. That first read-through was pretty bad for me. Chris and Craig are such good sight readers. Hattie is very good. But I was very bad at that time. Danny, on the other hand, has a unique style when he first reads a script. He seems to be scanning through different pages to everyone else. Sometimes he's even looking through a different script. Sometimes he's not even looking at the script. He's reading about how much Pavarotti earns in a newspaper. It gets to his line and the room falls silent for a moment. Danny looks around him with a big grin on his face. He's happy. Danny, it's your line, man, says Craig.
What?
Says Danny. It's your line, man, says Craig.
Page 32, Dan, says Chris.
Oh, yeah,
says Danny, finding the page. He clears his throat and says his line, which is,
What's happening?
Everybody laughs a great deal and the reading continues. The first time this happened, Hattie and I were out of the picture. We didn't understand the long history Danny already had with the company. It would appear to the casual observer that Danny had no idea what was going on. He would smile and look around when it was his cue, and Craig would do his line for him. Then put him in front of an audience, and he is always on cue, always getting the laugh. Or as Danny would say,
Kicking comedy booty, guy.
I read terribly that first day. I suddenly felt completely out of my depth. I was sitting around a table with a group of people who all knew each other well and who had been working in television for years. I had been working as a performer for years, but with only limited experience of TV. I wasn't even playing a human. I was playing a mechanoid called Crichton. I didn't know what he was supposed to be, what he looked like, where he came from, why he was there. I didn't know anything. At that time, I'd never seen the episode in the second series where Crichton first appeared. At that time, Crichton was played by David Ross, who later became Talky Toaster, and who put in a magnificent performance as the headmaster in Alan Bleasdale's GBH. I read Crichton in my own voice, and what were very funny lines came out about as amusing as dog poo. At the end of a marathon read, 6 half-hour scripts, all of which took longer than that to read, it was hard for me not to be a little despondent. It seemed like such a mammoth task ahead. All these thousands of words to learn, and I hadn't written them. This was the part that was so different for me. I had spent the previous 10 years learning lines almost as I had written them. I had written everything I'd ever performed, except once when I was in a play at the Sheffield Crucible Theatre called The True Story of the Titanic. It was a sort of musical comedy satire thing equating the sinking of the Titanic with Thatcher's Britain. I played about 6 different characters, had loads of lines to learn which were written by somebody else, and I found it very hard. The director would happily verify that I had trouble learning my lines. His name is Stephen Daldry. He was a scruffy git in those days. Now he's gone all posh. He ran the Royal Court Theatre in London. He's directed a couple of films you might have seen. Billy Elliot. I keep seeing him on the telly winning awards for amazing plays he's directed. He dresses very smartly and has a nice haircut. But when he was trying to get me to do a dance piece and say lines at the same time, his abilities in coaxing a performance out of an actor were stretched to the limit. Maybe I helped him, though. You know, maybe after he'd been through this difficult experience with me, he was a stronger, better director. After seeing me trip over and forget my lines 800 times in rehearsal, every other actor he would work with would be a breeze. To give myself a small break, I never blew it in a performance, though. And in that respect, I'm like Danny. Give me an audience, and I can remember things my day-to-day brain would find utterly incomprehensible. The play in Sheffield was performed by what I refer to as proper actors. These are people who've been to drama school and done proper acting training, have learned how to absorb lines, learned stagecraft, understand music and dance, can do proper singing. I was in a musical theatre group for 5 years. I just used to mouth along with the songs most of the time. Then it looked like I was singing, but it sounded much better. The cast of Red Dwarf, however, were not proper actors in those terms. As I said, I came out of the alternative comedy brigade of the late 70s and early 80s. Craig Charles started life as a performance poet. Chris Barry I first saw doing impressions in a late-night comedy club. Hattie does devastatingly funny deadpan comedy routines. Danny was in Cats, Starlight Express and loads of other musicals as a dancer. Danny has those proper dancer's legs. You know, the ones with massive calves that can spring him 8 feet into the air. That was my problem. Before going to the read-through, I had reassured myself that I was working with a group of people who were more like me. Not proper actors, but renegade comics who wouldn't be able to read scripts well the first time. I was very wrong. As soon as the read-through was over, everyone got up and started talking to each other. I went to the special BBC tea table, which all those rehearsal rooms have. As I was making myself some tea, Beth Ann Jones asked me if it would be all right to try on my head, as the first mask was ready. I agreed. Rob and Doug came up to me, and we talked about what Crichton should sound like. I said that I didn't want him to be English, because then he was bound to sound like R2-D2, or was it C-3PO? Anyway, the humanoid one who said, "Oh no, Master Luke." It would be so easy to say, "Oh no, Master Dave," and end up having a totally unoriginal robot on your hands. Rob smiled and smoked. Doug walked in little circles, nodding and saying, "Yeah, yeah, 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 no. What about a walk?" said Rob. The walk, the moment I'd been dreading. When I first met Rob and Doug weeks before, they'd been sitting down behind a table. I was showing them my full range of comedy walks, which they seemed to admire. By the time of the read-through, though, I knew Doug had a false leg due to an accident when he was a kid. His walk is obviously affected by this, so my desire to do a comedy wobbly robo-walk was somewhat hampered. I had done a great many comedy walks in my time. In fact, one kind reviewer had once written, "Llewellyn's funny walks put John Cleese to shame." Well, I never like reviews which compare one performer to another, and they certainly didn't put John Cleese to shame. I mean, let's face it, had John Cleese been in the audience that night, I don't think he'd have got up out of his seat after seeing my funny walk and said, "That's it, I'll never perform again, I feel put to shame." That's not a very good John Cleese impression, but let's leave that. My lack of desire to start comedy walking certainly wasn't Doug's fault. It's painfully clear he didn't give a toss about it. It was all my own inner, middle-class, guilt-ridden rubbish getting in the way. The big problem with comedy walks is that they invariably mimic someone who is disabled in some way. It's a problem with a lot of character comedy. You are often imitating someone who isn't normal in the dull grey sense of the word. You are being someone who is a bit bonkers, or a tosser, or a sad old git. But comedy walks have a specific danger all of their own. When on tour with the Joeys during a get-in in a theatre in Swansea, I did my Douglas Bader comedy walk to pass the time and keep up the morale of my co-performers. Douglas Bader was a fighter pilot in the Second World War who lost both legs in plane crashes, but went on to learn to walk again. He had a very specific walk. It's the only way you can walk if you keep both knees straight and don't flex your ankles. You have to get all your movement from your lower back and pelvic girdle. A lot of men don't think they've got a pelvic girdle. They think a girdle is a lady's thing. But we do have them, which proves that all men are a bit girly anyway. So there I was, doing my Douglas Bader walk across the stage. My fellow performers and road manager were egging me on, thinking it was all terribly clever and funny. Then a charming old man came in at the back of the theatre and stood still for a moment. He called out, "Would you like some tea?" We waved and said we'd love some. Then I watched in horror as this man turned with great difficulty and walked out. He did a Douglas Bader walk. He had no legs. Well, he had two false legs. He'd been watching me do my funny walk, probably thinking I was taking the piss. I felt, well, let's say I flew over the pit of utter shame in a hang glider with no canvas. Pulling faces or gurning can be a dangerous occupation as well. Another kind reviewer once said, Llewellyn's facial gymnastics have to be seen to be believed. I like that one. Facial gymnastics. Nice one. Had that one put on the poster, I can tell you. But there is a downside to facial gymnastics as well. In one Joey show, there was a sketch about the Law Lords. It implied Britain's top judges were like mummified relics from a bygone age. I played the mummy, which involved funny walks and a great deal of highly energetic facial gymnastics. One night in a theatre in Canterbury, I think, we had a brilliant audience, half of which came from a local special school. They were amazing, loving every minute of the show and screaming for more. However, there was one guy in the front row who didn't have a lot of control over his face, and when I walked forward being the judge, I noticed him looking at me. To portray a 3,000-year-old mummified judge, I was distorting my face in an unnervingly similar way to him. I felt terrible. Then he burst out laughing and pointed at me. I didn't take much comfort from this at the time, but on reflection, there is no reason on earth why my face shouldn't have been just as funny to him as it was to anyone else. It's a difficult area, and one I'm useless at. I always seem to blow it by trying to be too careful. In fact, the year Mammon was running in Edinburgh, I met a wonderful man called Jag Pla. Jag is an Indian stand-up comic who can only just stand up. He's been disabled from birth. He stumbles onto a stage, which takes some time, and advises the audience to talk among themselves while he gets to the microphone. He then grabs the mic stand and drops his crutches. He looks at them lying on the floor and says, "Look at them! They're useless without me!" I learned a great deal from being with Jag. One of the main things being that if you ignore someone's disability, you're not being honest with them. You're pretending there's nothing wrong. He would always confront able-bodied people's discomfort head-on. We once went out to eat in a restaurant in Edinburgh that had a steep flight of steps to the entrance. As we were leaving, a young Canadian couple in tartan shirts were waiting to go in. As soon as they realised Jag was on crutches, they looked away. I suppose in the belief that they would embarrass him with their stares. I could suddenly see what it must be like to be studiously ignored by everyone who sees you. Jag responded by shouting, "Stand back! Crip coming!" The Canadian couple winced. To hear the term Crip coming from someone like Jag obviously jangled their liberal nerves. But to ignore him was to be more offensive than calling him a Crip. When Jag spoke or walked, it was painfully clear that it was more effort for him than for most other people. That was all. In every other respect, Jag was a bog-standard, egotistical male stand-up comic who lecherous after women. One difference was he didn't drink. He claimed in his comedy routine that if he drank alcohol, he felt completely legless. I should have been super cool about Doug's leg, but I didn't know him then, and I felt very uncomfortable. I decided to go for broke, though, and suggested I would base Crichton's walk on a kid I was at school with. He had muscular dystrophy, a wasting nerve disease, but at the age of 15 he was still able to walk. He was the hero of our class, mainly because he was so funny. Kids can be really horrible about that sort of thing, but for some reason our class had really taken this boy under their wing. If he answered a teacher's question, he would put his hand up by swinging his shoulders and flicking his arm up, and then holding his elbow with the other hand. This style of attracting the teacher's attention quickly caught on, and soon we were all doing it. I think it had a beneficial influence on the whole class. We were the bad lads of the school, in the problem class, because putting your hand up to answer a question was such fun, we started to pay attention. This boy's walk was also very peculiar. He would flick his legs forwards with a twist of the hips, sort of like Douglas Bader with rubber knees. When I perambulated across the floor like this for Rob and Doug, they clearly liked what they saw. Doug walked around in a circle, nodding and saying, "No, no, yeah, yeah, no, yeah." Rob smoked another 5 cigarettes and said, "Very funny, Bobby." Ed Bye wanted to know what sort of voice I was going to use. I searched my brains for all the daft comic characters I'd done over the year. Toby, the chinless wonder upper-class twit with buck teeth. Sir George Sprout, the gout-ridden old landowner. The boy Tom, the ancient rustic know-all. Steve Kresh Ponytail, the massively right-on non-sexist man. None of them fitted the bill. I tried my Dutch hippie accent. "Oh, hello there." And then I tried my Scandinavian. "Oh, there we go, ditch is very nice." It was a character I'd used in my stand-up comedy set who talked about having sex on a beanbag in a striped-vine living room with a Janis Joplin poster on the wall. Oh, it was all very droll at the time, but it doesn't work out of context. This accent tickled Ed. It has a daft sing-song quality to it, a charming innocence or stupidity, depending on your viewpoint. As I did the walk and the voice, the general consensus seemed to be settling on Crichton being a Swedish mechanoid. Very clean and tidy, very Swedish, a sort of Volvo robot with side impact bars. It felt good. I seemed to have cracked it. Then Rob and Doug started walking around, standing in a huddle, smoking and talking. I didn't really notice this. I was just perfecting my walk, watching myself in the large mirror attached to one wall. Just as the character was starting to work for me, Rob walked up and said,
"The Scandinavian stuff."
I said, "Yeah, yeah, it feels really good."
"No,"
said Rob.
"It's going to drive people insane. That voice really gets to you after a while. What about American?"
"Yeah, American, no, yeah, yeah."
"Yeah, yeah, American, no, yeah, yeah, no,"
said Doug. It made some sense in some ways. A robot was far more likely to come from America than Sweden. You can see here how strongly I hold on to my opinions. I don't swim with the tide. I stick to my beliefs. Sometimes, for a bit, as long as everyone likes me. I did my Californian, my bland Midwest. They're all a bit dull. Then I explained that I'd spent some time in Vancouver a few years before, having sex with a blonde Canadian woman in funny positions in various natural woodland settings. Not that the sex was important to the accent, although her accent was great. It was a sort of American-Swedish. Canadians have a very similar sing-song quality, and West Coast Canadians have a very peculiar vowel sound, which I believe is strongly influenced by Scottish people who settled there about 100 years or so ago. I tried the walk again, now with a distorted Canadian accent.
"Ew, hello there, Mr. David, sir. I have your breakfast, just as you ordered it."
That was it. In some ways, Crichton, as I portray him, was born at that moment. Obviously, when I finally had the whole costume on, the walk changed. The arm movements were defined by what I could and couldn't do. But the voice is more or less the same. However, there is no rest for the egotistical, and no sooner was I riding the crest of a comedy wave in the rehearsal room than Beth Ann Jones led me into a little side room, sat me on a chair, and slicked back my hair. This is the first stage in the makeup procedure. I was having the first test of Crichton's head. Next came the bald cap, like a thin bathing cap that stuck to the skin with glue all around the hairline to hold it in place. Then the worst bit, the mask. A one-piece moulded balaclava of latex foam was pulled over my head like a giant split condom. First, they glued the rear section onto the back of my head. Then, starting with the forehead, they glued the mask to my face. Glue all over my nose, cheeks, lips, chin, neck and ears. In fact, more or less everywhere except my eyelids. I looked in a mirror and saw a very odd spectacle. The mask was unpainted and looked the same colour as a band-aid you might find floating in a swimming pool. A sort of dirty grey beige colour. The skin around my eyes looked very dark, so I could still, as it were, see myself under the rubber. Rob, Ed and Doug came in and stood around looking at it. Beth Ann Jones explained everything about the mask's difficulties to them. Rob smiled and smoked. Doug said,
"Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, yeah."
Ed By said,
"Well, chap, what's it like?"
I don't know what I said. I think we discussed the theory of irony. I said that it was ironic how when I first met them, I was worried about being recognised for being a robot, worried about getting typecast. Here I was, so well covered in prosthetic foam, even my own mother wouldn't recognise me. After about 20 minutes, Beth Ann Jones removed the mask and I was back to normal. Even that early on, a huge relief washed over me when the thing finally came off. I washed my face and felt it carefully with my hands. It felt new and different, even after such a short time. I made a mental note of the amount of days before the next mask was being applied, ready for the first day's filming, which was to take place in Liverpool.